don't need no education.
Welcome to Education Nation, where we tackle the biggest issues in American education. Your host is the headmaster of Liberty Classical Academy, Rebecca Hegstrom, along with co-host Mark Durkin. School is now in session.
Well, good morning, and thank you for joining us here on Education Nation. I'm your host, Rebecca Hegstrom, and as always, it's a privilege to join you this Saturday morning. And this morning, I do not have my wonderful co-host, Mark Durkin, joining me. He has a sick child at home and a wife who is off doing something else. So I am here going solo, and I will be joined in studio pretty soon, or joined by the phone, I should say, by a wonderful guest named Dr. Bob Osborne that I'll be introducing a bit later. So in a 2016 audit determined that the Minnesota State teacher licensing system was broken. And with that conclusion reached, the 2017 legislature ended with a passage of new laws that dramatically changed Minnesota's teacher licensing system. And beginning on July 1st of this year, all teacher applicants that meet eligibility requirements will be placed into a tiered licensing system. The Omnibus Education Bill passed by the Minnesota State Legislature last year will consolidate the responsibilities of the Minnesota Department of Education and the Board of Teaching into one organization called the Professional Educator Licensing and Standards Board, which they are calling PELSB. In addition to issuing or denying license applications and adopting rules to license public school teachers, PELSB has proposed a rule that would mandate cultural competency training for teachers. And according to Minnesota statutes found in Section 120B, cultural competency training means a training program that promotes self-reflection and discussion on all of the following topics: racial, cultural, and socioeconomic groups, American Indian students, implicit bias, systemic racism, gender identity, including transgender students, sexual orientation, language diversity, and individuals with disabilities. And training programs must be designed, according to this new rule, to increase teacher understanding of these topics and their ability to implement this knowledge with students, families, and the school community. Well, you can imagine that there's some critics out there, and the critics argue that the board's new rule is a Trojan horse designed to introduce social justice advocacy in schools across the state. And that source is from Intellectual Takeout. If you've listened to Education Nation much over the last 2 months, we've extensively covered this very transformation, specifically through Catherine Kirsten, who is a senior policy fellow at the Center of the American Experiment. She has highlighted for us the transformation from rigorous academic excellence to a social justice curriculum, which is anchored in racial identity politics, particularly in the Edina public school system. And opponents of this rule change also say that the board's actions are undemocratic, noting that the training requirement was not included in legislation signed by Governor Dayton. Simply put, state lawmakers say the board does not have the authority to rewrite the statute. Well, according to State Senator Carla Nelson of Rochester, PELSB, that organization that was just formed, was not granted open-ended rulemaking authority by the legislature. The permanent rules PELSB is proposing exceed its legal mandate. As it's becoming clear that cultural competency trainings could potentially be conducted from a government-mandated worldview, one man who has spent much of his working career invested in cultural diversity hopes that PELSB, as a government agency, will not impose a government-mandated viewpoint. Dr. Bob Osborne has more than 30 years of professional experience serving in the International Student and Academic Ministry at the University of Minnesota. He's attuned to the need for understanding diverse cultural perspectives that human beings bring with them. His work includes a PhD in international education from the University of Minnesota in 2005. And from 2008 until 2014, Dr. Osborne taught an undergraduate course at the University of Minnesota on religion and education policy. And for the past 3 years, he has taught an online course through the Wilberforce Academy on comparative worldviews with students literally around the world. Dr. Osborne also serves as the executive director of Wilberforce Academy, training international graduate students how to solve problems in their very diverse home societies. Dr. Osborne, thank you for joining us this morning on Education Nation.
Rebecca, it's a great pleasure of mine to be with you.
Wonderful. And I just like to note for our listeners that Dr. Osborne and I met many years ago through your work at the McLaren Institute at the University of Minnesota.
That's right.
And
Known as Anselm House.
Yes, Anselm House, exactly. Yes. And they do great work introducing students of all backgrounds to Christian point of view, as well as other diverse perspectives, and really starting a good conversation. I really appreciate what they do there.
Indeed.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's just jump right in here then, Dr. Osborne. I'm going to ask, you know, on this very first question, sort of in regards to the proposed rule, your chief concern is that the rule fosters a government-mandated perspective on cultural topics, such as we have seen in some places, as they pertain to gender identity and racism, just to name a couple. When you read the language, or when you read the language in the proposed rule, what frameworks can teachers expect their cultural competency training to come through?
Well, Rebecca, this is exactly the heart of my concern, and mm-hmm. that is that when teachers learn about gender identity, racism, and all the other topics, there's about a list of 10 or 12 in that rule.
Mm-hmm.
What we understand and what we can recognize right away is that those topics are framed by a particular worldview that we call postmodernism.
Mm-hmm.
This worldview is one of many worldviews or frameworks for understanding our task as educators, but it's a worldview that is built on the central proposition that we must rectify power imbalances. We must remove oppression. In mm-hmm. fact, another term for the postmodern worldview, a term that's used more frequently in education, is the term critical theory.
Mm-hmm.
But in reality, critical theory is nothing but a version of what I would call cultural Marxism.
Mm-hmm.
So there is a perspective behind this language that they're using in the rule, and that concerns me greatly.
Mm-hmm. And why don't you tell our listeners a little bit more about what cultural Marxism really is? Because I think for a lot of people, that might be a foreign term.
Yeah, so essentially what Marx was trying to say back 150 or more years ago was that the masses of workers are oppressed by their employers. Their mm-hmm. employers use them essentially as like wage slaves.
Mm-hmm.
And Marx said that the workers will rise up and they will throw off the chains of their oppression. And they will ultimately gain equality, economic equality with their bosses.
Mm-hmm.
Now, cultural Marxism is a variant on that, and it says essentially the same thing, except that it doesn't focus on economics. But what it does say is that some people, namely in our current discourse, the mm-hmm. people who have the power are white people, largely, mm-hmm. and especially those who have a Christian background.
Mm-hmm.
And their teaching is that we must raise up the consciousness of people in minority groups and other groups that are not well represented in the leading sectors in society, and that they must be empowered, they must throw off the chains of their cultural oppression, and thus become equally in the same power status as with the so-called former white oppressors.
Hmm. Very interesting. You know, the term cultural Marxism gets thrown around quite a bit. And I tell you, I think you're the first person who's ever explained it so clearly and accurately. And that's so helpful. And, you know, we are seeing, you're right, we're seeing this all around. When we had Catherine Kirsten on talking about the racial identity politics that had really entered the Edina public schools, I can see where it really does have roots in this type of thinking that you just described for us. And, you know, you see Christians who, I guess, evidently historically tend to be more white. Is that what their idea is? Because when I stop and think about it, there's a lot of Christians around the world that aren't white. So why do they associate this with just whiteness?
Well, that's part of the complete irony of the whole thing, is that increasingly white people are becoming an almost tiny minority of the world Christian population.
Right.
There are hardly any Christians left in all of Europe, at most maybe mm-hmm. 10 or 20 million. And in America, there may be 80 million or so. And so that is in terms of, you know, really Christ-following Christians from whatever background.
Mm-hmm.
So whereas around the world, there are a total of 2.2 billion
wow.
professing Christians. The vast majority are in Asia and in Africa.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
In one sense, these people who are promoting the cultural Marxist mm-hmm. or postmodern worldview mm-hmm. are actually working with a very outdated perspective on reality.
Right, right. Yeah, I was just going to say the premise of their argument is completely off. It's, you know,
absolutely.
So that's really interesting. Well, are you of the belief, Dr. Osborne, that cultural competency training for teachers from a social justice lens is a potential violation of the First Amendment then? And can you explain to us what your thoughts are?
Indeed. I do believe, and I've stated this in a letter to the Department of Education, that I believe the language and the proposed rule is a violation of the First Amendment, which says in the first part of that, the very first phrase says, Congress shall make no law regarding or respecting an establishment of religion.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what you have to understand is that back in 1791, when the First Amendment was passed,
mm-hmm.
The idea of religion was roughly equivalent to the concept of worldview today. A worldview is the eyeglasses or the perspective through which we make sense of reality.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone has one or more worldviews that are shaping their way of recognizing and understanding reality.
Mm-hmm.
So today, religions as well as non-religious philosophies like postmodernism or is often called critical theory or cultural mm-hmm. Marxism, these are, in fact, worldviews.
Mm-hmm.
And so what the proposed rule is really trying to do, either naively or willfully, it's trying to use the power of government coercion in order to train our teachers and their students
mm-hmm.
in a particular government-endorsed worldview that in turn views human affairs through the lens of the oppressor and the oppressed.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm very convinced that our First Amendment absolutely forbids the use of government to coerce its citizens, whether it's teachers or students, to embrace a particular worldview. We've been through this fight many times over the last several centuries, mm-hmm. and we ought to be very clear about it now, but these folks are once again trying to impose a particular perspective that is simply not acceptable to many of us who see reality in a very different way.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's really a good point that you make, that when you go back to the founders, they were looking at a particular worldview, because I think oftentimes today where the confusion comes in is people think, well, it's not a religious viewpoint and therefore it's unbiased. They think if it's unreligious
exactly.
or irreligious, that means it's unbiased. But the two don't equate
exactly.
at all. And that I really do believe is at the core of the confusion. And even, like you say, even if it's willful on their part, they may still be doing it naively in the sense that they're not thinking that they are doing anything wrong, in the sense that they're not telling anybody how to think in a particular religious perspective. But what they're missing is that they're still telling them how to think and how to view the world, which, as you point out, is a worldview, which then is equated with a type of a religious philosophy. It has those same underpinnings.
Yeah, pretty. You said it very well, Rebecca.
Hmm. Well, in more than 30 years of working professionally with international students, you are definite in your conviction that educators have the need for understanding diverse cultural perspectives. Human beings bring many different cultural perspectives with them, and you realize the importance of recognizing that. So can you explain to our listeners how the need for educators and students to understand those diverse cultures and interpretations actually comes best when teachers are not forced to endure training that really fails to allow for those legitimate differences?
Yes, Rebecca, as an international educator, I'm highly sensitive to this issue, and I very, very much want educators to teach students about how others view reality and
mm-hmm.
how they experience reality.
Mm-hmm.
So I want my students, and we should want our students, to try to to get inside the mind of, say, the animist mm-hmm. who comes perhaps from Laos or somewhere else, mm-hmm. or the Muslim who comes from Somalia. That this is really good cultural competency training. This is the kind of thing that invites people to actually empathetically see reality from another's perspective, from inside another pair of shoes. Mm-hmm. All good education enables us to do that, mm-hmm. whether it's in the area of literature or it's in social studies or in any of our humanities or social sciences. We want to be able to imagine what it's like to be that person and to see reality that way. Mm-hmm. And so when you teach about something, you're inviting people, you're not forcing people, you're inviting them to come along with you. Mm-hmm. But what you're not doing is you're not telling them that is a right perspective, or it's the only perspective, or it's the perspective that one must have.
Exactly.
And so that's what I so seriously challenge, is the implicit indoctrination mm-hmm. that is behind the proposed rule mm-hmm. of the professional educators licensing and standards board.
Right, right. And such an important point, because some people might accuse you of saying, or accuse you of not wanting diversity, and just the opposite. You actually do want genuine diversity.
Ooh.
And what you're seeing is, in this licensure rule, you're actually eliminating that diversity of thought. So such an important point. Well,
and I might just add to
go ahead.
As well, Rebecca, mm-hmm. in a very real way, there's a certain kind of patronizing spirit
yeah.
behind this kind of thing. It's as if we can patronize people of other perspectives by using the kind of postmodern or critical theory that is assumed in this rule.
Mm-hmm.
But that's really patronizing mm-hmm. to people from around the world who come to Minnesota, mm-hmm. as well as people in Minnesota who hold, just mm-hmm. for other reasons, us different worldviews.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and another very important point. Well, we discussed critical theory just a few minutes ago. You've mentioned it a few times. What are some of the arguments that critical theorists try to raise against educators that simply want to be faithful to their own consciences when it comes to issues of cultural competency?
The most common one, Rebecca, is that the majority white, and they will often add the word Christian,
mm-hmm.
Population is simply blind to its own privilege and its own bias.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, I agree that sometimes that is the case, but what it ignores is what we talked about earlier, and that is that most Christians in the world are not white,
right.
First of all, and secondly, it makes the assumption that skin color is the primary determinant in human affairs.
Exactly.
And that is absolutely not the case.
Yeah. Once again, yep. such a false premise. Go ahead. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Another argument that goes along with this is that white people want to actually maintain their privilege and will subtly, often not openly, but will subtly use a oppression in order to maintain this kind of privilege. And what this is really boiling down to is the kind of identity politics that you and Catherine Kirsten have been talking about.
Mm-hmm.
What we want as Christians, what I believe the vast majority of Minnesotans want, is they simply want to understand truly about reality.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't want it somehow forced through a critical theory lens mm-hmm. that accuses a number of our citizens of trying to oppress other people. It just isn't the case.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then that leads then to what I think is the third argument that the critical theorists are advancing, and that is, and it's again related, but it moves into the area of sexuality, and they're trying to say that it's wrong to educate students in a heteronormative way or with heteronormative assumptions about reality. So mm-hmm. what that's all about, when I use that big law word,
yeah.
is simply the idea that
yeah.
that there are really only two genders, mm-hmm. men and women, mm-hmm. male and female. And they will work very hard with the language that I see in the proposed rule to absolutely destroy that idea of two genders.
Mm-hmm.
And they will argue that there's a difference between our biological sex and our psychological gender, and that there's somewhere between 11 and 55 different genders. And that is simply implausible to the vast majority of right-thinking and mostly clear-thinking Minnesotans.
Yeah, Christian or not. That's
absolutely.
Yeah, so it's almost like they use, in that particular example anyway, it's almost like they hide behind this shroud of, you know, white Christian, you know, kind of emboldening or trying to put down other people, when really the issue that they are raising is objectionable to the vast majority of people in Minnesota, I would say.
Absolutely.
I don't have proof of that, but that's my guess in talking to various people around the Twin Cities on both sides of the aisle. I think that there's a big resistance to that, whether you're white or black or whether you're Christian or not. And so that's an interesting perspective that they would kind of shroud their concerns in the white Christian privilege viewpoint.
Yeah, that's right.
Bob, you're a firm believer that religion is a profoundly important aspect of cultural development for both Minnesotans and international students. And when a government-mandated understanding is required, this causes really quite a conflict for the religious students and their academic experiences. In your experience and in your research, what do you see as the main reasons for overlooking this very large factor in human development?
Well, Rebecca, I think first of all, it goes back to several things. But the first thing is that for about 200 years, Westerners have been subtly but progressively privatizing religion and walling it off from public life. Now, this was originally begun by a German philosopher by the name of Immanuel Kant, mm-hmm. who was really trying to protect Christianity from what he saw as the impending attacks from science.
Hmm.
But by privatizing religion, what he effectively did was to take away its ability to influence public affairs. Hmm. And that is simply not how reality works. Mm-hmm. All religions, to one degree or another, are inherently public. They're not merely private.
Mm-hmm.
Talk to any Muslim in the state of Minnesota, and they will tell you that the whole concept of privatization of religion is completely alien to Islam, mm-hmm. but it's actually completely alien to a Christian perspective mm-hmm. on reality, as it is to a Jewish perspective or a Buddhist or Hindu or any other perspective. So mm-hmm. we want to move away from this concept of privatization. But that's been one of the main reasons why it's been overlooked, and it is overlooked tragically in the current rule that's being proposed.
Mm-hmm.
But I think there's another issue that we really have to talk about, Rebecca, mm-hmm. and that is the fact that by keeping, and I think this is a naive, I'm not accusing the rule writers of mm-hmm. trying to do this with intent,
mm-hmm.
but by keeping religion out of this consideration of cultural diversity and cultural competency, what they have really done is they've essentially said, we're going to rig the rules so there's only one basic worldview by which you can understand reality, that is our postmodern critical theory, cultural Marxist perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to prevent religion from doing what it normally does, which is it also makes assessments mm-hmm. about public policy.
Right.
And in often cases, it will disagree with secularists who mm-hmm. are trying to, often with good intents in mind, impose their views on society.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that this is really unhealthy to have this walling off of religion away from public policymaking, because it gives effectively secularists free rein to try to shape education, and that is bad for Minnesotans, it's bad for students, it's bad for teachers, and it's bad for public policy.
Mm-hmm. And that brings us back to why you believe it is also against the First Amendment, because if it really
Absolutely.
Can silence the religious piece of an individual, then it is trampling on that individual's First Amendment rights. And essentially, that's what this law, or it's not a law, I guess it's a rule, would actually cause to happen. So that's an important point that you're making. And just to clarify for our listeners, if they're not sure what you mean by privatizing of religious views. Basically, I think that's self-explanatory, but just to be clear, you know, you're talking about not allowing your faith to be kind of seen in public, or not allowing it to affect public policy or affect the decisions that we make in public. It's almost as though you can only practice your religion in the four walls of your church or the four walls of your home, and everywhere else you have to sort of just pretend like you don't even have that faith. But that's being inconsistent, and that's why the Muslims that you're talking about, that's foreign to them, because that's not the way they were brought up in their religion. Their religion is very much a part of their public life, and really that's how it was in America. The Judeo-Christian ethic was very much a part of the public life, and that's why we have 10 commandments, you know, in so many public places. And I think sometimes the postmodernists forget that is the foundation of this country, and that to try to get away from that is really stepping on the religious freedom of those who still practice and believe that.
Yeah, there is a certain other irony here that I might just add to that point, which is a very good one that you've made, Rebecca, and that is that postmodernists actually, and I'm not just trying to put down postmodernism, I'm rejecting a particular expression of it known as critical theory or cultural Marxism, but they would say that, yes, everything is a perspective, but in doing so, they want to maintain the idea that religion, while it is a perspective, or the different religions have their own perspective, they still must keep it out of public life. Mm-hmm. And so they're trying, in a sense, to have their cake and trying to eat it too.
Right.
And I'm just trying to make them honest. Okay, let's all just come together in the public domain. Let's bring our perspectives, whatever they are, and let's have honest and sincere debates and discussions. We're going to ultimately have to take votes at some point on any given thing. Mm-hmm. When we're educating, let's educate about others' perspectives. Let's not say there is only one right perspective, at least when we're conducting public education. Certainly, when it comes to, you know, what we each believe, I certainly believe there's only one right perspective, and that's my Christian faith.
Right, right.
But when I'm educating, I'm going to give students the opportunity to say, I don't think you're right.
Precisely.
They have that privilege.
Right, and that's what is going to be lacking if this rule goes through, right? Yeah,
that's right.
So we are running short on time here, and I'm just going to jump down and ask you one more question here before the end. And
sure.
If you can just quickly answer, and then I want to move on to announce this meeting that is coming up next Friday. So, but if the board does insist on keeping this proposed language, what additions could you see made that would help educators to be faithful to their own consciences in important matters of cultural diversity? Just like 30
seconds.
Well,
there's several things. One, Rebecca, I want to see religion added to the mix of cultural competencies that teachers need to learn. Right now, the proposed rule doesn't make any reference whatsoever to religion. Secondly, if they insist on keeping the rule, then I want them to also indicate in the rule that educators' consciences must be respected, and they cannot be coerced via government imposition. And thirdly, I want the Professional Educators Licensing and Standards Board to acknowledge that it cannot and it should not impose a government-authorized view when it comes to cultural diversity and competency. Mm-hmm. That is not their calling. It's not their business. It is not the intent of the legislature, by the way, with respect to the rulemaking that was conducted last year in this regard. And it's not good public policy.
You did make that point that the legislature did not approve this body to be able to make these laws. And it's important to remember that. But I do want to just very quickly announce that there is a meeting, if you have more interest in learning more, Friday, March 2nd at 9:30 at the Professional Educator Licensing and Standards Board off of Highway 36 in Roseville. Again, that's Friday, March 2nd at 9:30 if you want to get more information. Thank you again for joining us, Dr. Osborne, and thank you to our listeners.
It's been my privilege.